Good morning and welcome. I'm Frank Verastro. I'm Director of the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning. This is the first of what we hope to be a series on the topic of nuclear energy, which is an increasingly important topic. As many of you may know, that we chair the geopolitics and policy portions of the National Petroleum Council, the Global Energy Study. And that study basically said that we will need all forms of energy going forward: conventional oil and gas, unconventional fuels, biofuels, renewables, and of course nuclear, if we're anywhere expected to get close to the forecast in increasing demand for the next 20, 25 years. And that's with a healthy chunk of efficiency gains as well. For those of you that have followed events here at CSIS, you know that we've done an awful lot in the realm of conventional and non-conventional oil and gas. We completed an alternative fuels series that basically focused on transportation fuels, and we expect to continue that in 2008 and expand looking at a carbon-constrained future, how we deal with fossil fuels. But we also intend to start looking at and spend more time. Go ahead. Dealing with the topics of coal, solar, and nuclear. And so today is really just kind of the first salvo at the nuclear exchange. In future sessions, we will address in greater detail the changing technology, siting and permitting issues, storage and proliferation issues. But this morning, the panel that we've kind of put together is what I think is the best and most diverse panel that we could get to kick off this event. Dr. Schlesinger will serve as the moderator for this morning's discussion, and I couldn't be more pleased at the selection of Jim to come here and join us and his ability to do that, because I know of no one with comparable experience, insight, and knowledge on the range of energy issues and also how they affect the economy, the environment, and our energy security. In an era of increasing partisan politics, especially in this town, Jim is one of those few remarkable people that has been able to serve effectively in both Democratic and Republican administrations. He's been head of the CIA, head of the Atomic Energy Commission, Secretary of Defense, Director of the Office of Management and Budget, and he was our first Secretary of Energy. He currently serves as Chairman of the Board of Trustees of the MITRE Corporation. He's a senior advisor at Lehman Brothers, and he's also a counselor here at CSIS. And in that context, he still retains my boss. So with no further ado, I will turn this over to Jim Schlesinger. We will post the entire presentations on our website, and this entire session is on the record. So thanks very much. Jim.
Well, thank you, Frank. I'm on behalf of Frank, who is in charge of our energy programs here at CSIS, and the president of CSIS, John Hamry, in the background. I welcome all of you to this session on nuclear power. In particular, we want to welcome our special guest, our keynote speaker, Dale Klein, like myself, a refugee from the Pentagon. Thank you for coming, Mr. Chairman. For those who have hungered and loved for many years, since the catastrophes of the 1970s, and we've looked forward to the revival of nuclear power, it looks as if the time has now come. And what has been thwarted love will no longer be thwarted. Let me tell you a couple of things about energy. First, fashions come and go in this business. A few months ago, we're talking about coal-fired plants. They are now under a cloud because of carbon dioxide releases. The number of compressors for gas-fired plants has tripled. And down the road, we will see a run-up in gas prices that will cripple that. And we may see a return to coal, for all I know. So that fashions come and go in the energy industry is one thing to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind is that it is basically quantitative. We are using well over 30 billion barrels of oil a year. You don't change that quickly. Here in the United States, we have over 800 gigawatts of electric generating capacity. You don't change that quickly. Politicians tend to think in terms of symbolism. That's the way they get by. But that doesn't change the energy economy. So keep in mind the quantitative aspects. Since this is a discussion of nuclear energy, I want to say that sometimes it has been treated as a panacea. Indeed, ever since 1973, with the arrival of energy independence and the energy independence blueprint, presidents have said nuclear energy. So I will tell you what nuclear energy cannot do. It cannot solve the energy problem. It cannot solve the energy problem because our energy problem is basically fuel liquids and imported oil. And having a different mechanism to generate electric power doesn't as yet solve that problem. Down the road, it may solve the problem as we move into plug-in hybrids, and that all generating capacity can help substitute down the road for imported oil. But at the moment, it does very little. What else will it not do? It will not stop the release of greenhouse gases. It can make a contribution. It will make a contribution over time, but it will not stop the release of greenhouse gases. Why is that? I go back to my original comments that it is now some 35 years since we ordered a nuclear plant that actually went online. And the industry has been substantially reduced, if not decimated. People have left the industry. The infrastructure is down. You have higher material costs. I close by saying that my own son helped build four nuclear plants. He's no longer in the industry, and he is not planning to go back. So that rebuilding the capacity will be a critical obstacle. Recreating the capacity to build plants. It has been estimated by the IEA that in order to deal with global warming, we would have to build 30 nuclear plants a year from 2013 to 2030. We are not going to be doing that. And that would be a way of preventing the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere from going much over 450 parts per million. This morning's speakers, the first is Phil Sharp, sometimes head of the Institute of Politics at Harvard University, 10-term congressman. He is the head of resources for the future. In the world of energy, which is filled with passions, which is filled with, if I may say so, paranoia, the resources for the future tries to keep us straight. And Phil is the man who heads resources for the future. Phil, I should say, Phil will talk more generally about energy and where nuclear fits in. Marv will talk about the specific role for nuclear power. And then Mr. Wallace will talk about the plans that Constellation has to actually build some plants. Phil.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Jim. I'm delighted to be here. I very much appreciate Frank inviting me to be a part of this. In fact, frankly, as a former member of Congress, I'm happy to be invited anywhere. But it's a particular honor to be here with James Schlesinger, who clearly is one of the wise men and women of this whole area of economy, energy, geopolitics in this country. And one of our other colleagues, Charlie Curtis, is another of those folks. There may be others in the room, but we're now aged enough I can't see that far to be able to tell. But all three of us go back to the 1970s when people were, until Three Mile Island, still very much committed to the assumption that nuclear power would be a major part of our energy supply in this country. And, of course, it is a major part, a major component, but not to the degree that was expected at that time. Let me quickly indicate a caveat at Resources for the Future. Our folks, our scholars, do independent analysis, primarily economic analysis. They do economics. I'm not going to this morning. And so to defend them and the institution, I must ask you to give them a pass on what I'm going to say, because I'm going to do more of a comment on politics based on my experience in Congress in dealing with some of these issues when I was chair of the subcommittee that had jurisdiction over the NRC from the late 80s to the early 90s, and also later served on the board of directors of a subsidiary board of NYSE when National Grid took them over to oversee their minority interests in six plants, and I'm on the advisory panel to INPO. I don't tell you that to say that's a lot of expertise. It's just a different kind of perspective, because I don't have the kind of daily expertise of some of the people you're going to be hearing from today. Also, I chaired the advisory panel to the MIT study on the future of nuclear power. The advisory panel was simply a sounding board. We are not responsible for the real work that went on there. I think the most central point, which Jim has already alluded to here, is that the political and business climate for nuclear power has seen a very significant change, certainly from the 1980s and the 1990s, when both in politics and and among economists, investors, and others, it just seemed to be clearly nowhere. Indeed, when the 2003 report of MIT came out on the future of nuclear power, and this is a report that seeks to say, what do we do to keep this option open? So it's, in one sense, a very pro-nuclear development a report. Nonetheless, the context that they identify in the first paragraph, just let me read you a sentence to give you a characterization of what in 2003 was probably still the prevailing opinion. It was that at present, however, nuclear power could be one of the options for reducing carbon emissions. At present, however, this is unlikely. Nuclear power faces stagnation and decline. And now this was just in 2003. I think things have changed very clearly even since that time kind of proposition. In fact, indeed, I would argue that in many circles today that are dealing with climate change and dealing with energy, that a prevailing point of view is that if we're going to seriously do something about climate by the year 2050, nuclear power will be needed as a part of, though as Jim says, it is by no means a sure shot for solving the problem as a whole. Indeed, as the MIT report concludes and others have reported, it's going to take aggressive efficiency, it's going to take aggressive renewables, it's going to take coal sequestration, but it will also take a nuclear power. None alone will be able to do it. Now, the major problems, as this report identifies, that it continues to face, and the industry is working on, and the government regulators are working on all four of these particular problems, but they are the natural ones that are pretty well universally identified. One is how to maintain cost control or get the cost down for the new power plants and whatnot. Certainly, the industry has been shown a remarkable capacity to do that in terms of operation of the current fleet. And the issue is, can you do that in terms of being competitive with other sources of fuel? The second, of course, the profound issue always is maintaining safety. And we're here again since Three Mile Island in this country, since Chernobyl in 1986, we've seen a very, very positive record with the one serious concern in this case of the Davis-Bessie corrosion there, which the management, it appears, failed to be on top of, and it's not clear that the nuclear regulators were on top of the management on this issue early enough as well. Though the result, as is typical of these kind of things, is to to really shake up people in the industry and in the regulatory establishment to try to stay ahead of any potential problems. So we saw no real consequences for any individuals as a result of that risky proposition. Third issue, of course, is waste, how to manage the waste issue. This continues to frustrate us politically, if not to some degree technically, but and then the fourth, of course, is international proliferation, which in the report they outline certain steps that could be taken in all four of these areas to help assure that there could be an ongoing option, a serious option of nuclear power. Indeed, it seems to me, this may be a somewhat of a cute and overstatement of the situation, but the real criticism and negativism on nuclear power comes from aging environmental leaders and aging utility leaders who got their jobs as CEOs as a result of the previous management's failures to be able to manage the construction of their nuclear plants. So both of these are among the most skeptical people that exist, but as typical on most issues, progress follows the hearse. To try to characterize, and this again is always subject to change, but I think what has increasingly happened in a broad set of circles dealing with energy and dealing with climate is the belief that the risk of climate trump the risk of nuclear power as a general proposition. That doesn't mean you don't have to get down to very important specifics, but I think that is a significant political change. Let me just take a quick cut at some of the situation in terms of new construction, because you're going to hear a lot of detailed work on this. And here again, I think the political risks are significantly less than they were even 5 or 6 years ago in this country. First of all, we do have a change, as I'm sure Chairman Klein will talk about, in the process of licensing a plant. It was actually made and codified in the law. The commission did the work on it, and the Congress in 1992 codified it into law to change the system, which in theory ought to be an easier system to get to decision, a final decision on, than what had previously existed. Of course, it remains untested because we've not ever used it, but I'm sure Chairman Klein will speak to how they are trying to make sure that system works effectively, both from the safety regulatory point of view and to getting to a decision, which is one of the key propositions in construction, is getting there. The second thing is that happened is politically is that we've already seen the politics change radically because we've had both the commission be able to do it and we've seen very little intervention from outsiders on the issue of extending licenses in this country. If one get back a decade, one would have expected that there would be severe challenge to every time a nuclear plant was going to try to extend their license. But in fact, we have not either seen the outside interveners, nor have we seen fundamental problems. There are some specific things that have had to be done in certain license extensions, but in fact, that has gone forward. So the expectation now is that nearly all of the plants, if they seek it, will get a plant life extension. That may be an overstatement, but that is a radical political shift in my view. The third thing that I would suggest here is that siting a new power plant, which you commonly hear from media and from others, is, oh, the American people won't let you site one anywhere. This is pure bunk and nonsense. The fact is we have a host of sites left over, admittedly, from the inability to build plants in the past that are, in essence, banked. And whether they're all appropriate for construction is a question that will have to be taken up in each case. But there are a number of sites, and we get all kinds of indications of local acceptance and desire to have more construction there because they're almost always next to an operating plant that is important to the local economy. So, in fact, I'd almost argue that today, politically, from a political point of view, it may well be easier to site a nuclear power plant than it is a coal plant in this country. just to show you again what Jim alluded to, the fashions come and go. This may be an overstatement, but one should not be caught up in the conventional wisdom that somehow this is politically impossible. Just pure nonsense. Now, try to do greenfield plants all over the place, and you can imagine all kinds of places where this would be difficult. I'm not sure I would want to try one in California right now, but the fact is that there are plenty of places, and a number are obviously, as people will point out to you, are under consideration and already making application. I think that the risk politically, the other kind of question that comes up is, well, but what if the government rules change? What if the rule makers, the commission changes? Couldn't this set back progress that's been made? Because I didn't allude to the fact that some of the others will, that there are already new economic incentives in place in the law to help get the first plants in place. Well, I think that, to be honest with you, I think it's unlikely that no matter who is president of the United States, that we will see an anti-nuclear platform. And indeed, it's kind of a myth about American politics that Congress was anti-nuclear and presidents were anti-nuclear. They took certain decisions sometimes that one could argue made it harder or set back the development of nuclear power. But in fact, never did a moratorium pass the U.S. Congress. During the Clinton administration, they continued R&D at fairly significant levels on a host of nuclear things. And the appointees at the NRC began extending licenses of plants. And I would think, given the importance of climate change, they will have difficulty with that, so that I would be surprised if plant licensing became a serious problem any more than just the reality is, and from a political point of view, other than the hard stuff that will be required no matter what in siting a plant. Secondly, if subsidies are actually granted, I would think it'd be hard to undo and unlikely to undo subsidies to a specific plant that had already received the application. Whether one keeps on the books subsidies in the future, that's always a proposition with any subsidies that we have. I think the real question is what happens to Yucca Mountain kind of proposition, and with the moving up of the the Nevada primary, that tends to get the attention of presidential candidates to this issue that they probably would be more than delighted to ignore and not have to take a position on. They are naturally inclined to save the people of Nevada from this nefarious proposition, although they live practically on top of the underground testing and all that we did for decades out there. I find it's hard for me to imagine which is a greater threat, but we do want to save Las Vegas as the great American icon, after all. You'll pardon my flippancy here, and please don't quote it to my friends from Nevada. I think that political risk, and I would also argue that the interesting thing about the Davis-Bessie near accident, or what I don't know how you describe it, is that it did command important attention from the industry in terms of shaping up and testing other places. It did command important from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But the nuclear critics either failed to be able, didn't have time for it, didn't focus on it, or whatever, but it did not become a cause celeb that it might have become 20 years ago as another warning against this. Let me quickly turn to some business risks, and I'll try to sum up here or get off the stage here. In terms of business risk, I think the positive thing is that current plants are clearly making money. They're making money because they have learned better management systems, collective management that others will allude to, I'm sure. They've significantly changed the amount of time they're down for refueling and other necessary things. And, of course, a number of them benefited from restructuring, which managed to find a way to pay down some of their sunk costs or their kind of propositions, which certainly was useful to them. Another irony is that some of the nuclear critics thought they could kill nuclear by deregulating the industry. Like so many things, and I'm not just picking on them because it happens on all sides, the consequences are often different than what one anticipates. The second thing I would say about the current plants is that competitive fuels, Jim already alluded to the
competitive fuels of natural gas and coal, but I think most interesting development is on the coal side. We've had a huge wave of natural gas plants in the 1990s and the early 2000s until the crisis in the cost of natural gas hit us a couple years ago. That has come back down, and so that is now a tendency to shift back toward natural gas. But we were looking for a huge wave of building of coal plants. And the interesting thing is how many over the last year have found themselves, have been taken off the table. Now, nobody expected all of them to ever be built. But the fact is that we've got example after example where they've either been actively turned down in a few cases at the regulatory agencies at the state level, or the investors have simply withdrawn the applications. In all cases, they are under specific challenge in every regulatory system. And I believe it's probably safe to say the ones that have been able to get a certificate to operate at the PUC level have all had to make some kind of political deal. In other words, they've had to agree to either a big efficiency program within the utility system or to undo other coal plants that they have or to engage in more efficient coal technologies or something of the sort, and increasingly being pushed that if they're going to get it, they're going to have carbon sequestration on the at that point when they go into operation. That has not been required any place, and that's a burden they could not get over at this point, but it's one that's being pushed by critics. So we have seen as much capacity as is about to be built fail and come offline as we've seen go online. And so this opens up, obviously. I won't say more about the other renewable and efficiency. I think the one big question ahead of us in this electric sector is just how much efficiency can and will we get out of the system. Everybody now is committed to the idea we've got to do a whale of a lot better in distribution, production, and end-use efficiency in the electric sector. Everybody's committed to it, but that mantra is stronger than the actions, and we'll see whether that happens. Let me turn to another of the business risks, and the major concern that I sense from talking to people on the new power plants is managing the construction so that you manage to complete in a timely way with a reasonable cost proposition, that you have some control over those costs, and that you have sufficient quality control that you'll be able to get past the regulators. Those are the issues that drove things economically off the table a number of years ago, and they are the things that worry boards of directors and CEOs and whatnot. Now, this issue is not being addressed. It's intensely being examined by everybody from utilities, investors, and certainly, as Marv will probably tell us, at the Nuclear Energy Institute, at the EPRI, at the IMPO, at EEI. They're highly focused on this because people sense the real importance of that first plant out of the box. If it does not meet these tests of costs and of timeliness and of quality control, it's going to be a real damper on every other effort that goes on. How much nuclear power will we have? I think that's just simply an unknowable proposition, as Jim already alluded to. But just to give you a sense from the MIT report of the magnitudes that Jim alluded to that we're talking about, they suggest in their report that compared to business as usual energy use as is expected, and we all know that won't be what's the case, but that's the projections out of IEA and others on general energy use, that if we have a threefold increase in nuclear power plants, that means also replacing some that will go offline between now and 2050, a threefold increase in power plants worldwide, we will still only cut carbon emissions by 25% of the growth that is expected in carbon emissions. So make no mistake, if we think that's a serious proposition, and I don't know what the goal should be, but I think the climate change issue is a serious proposition, this can play a part, and in my view, we must keep this option going precisely because the hurdles we've got to get over are huge. And nuclear, in my view, has got to be a part of that, but it's going to take some effective leadership politically and effective leadership business-wise, and I think we're beginning to see that in both cases. Thank you.
Thank you.
thank you very much, Phil, for a comprehensive political overview. And now we turn to a discussion of what the industry's hopes and fears are. Throughout these 30-odd years of yearning, the Nuclear Energy Institute has kept the flags flying. Marv Fertel is Senior Vice President of the NEI. He is the head of the Nuclear Generation Division at NEI ever since 2003. Marv.
Sorry about that. What I wanted to do was sort of set the stage a bit for Mike, who's going to talk about a real plant that's going forward in his company to be built, but to put in some perspective what is happening across our industry, but also to put in perspective, I support nuclear energy, but the real thing I support is we need a real reliable electricity supply system in our country. And this slide kind of gives you the snapshot of what we have in our country right now. And just going to something Jim said about 1973, in 1973 we were getting 20% of our electricity from oil and 4% of our electricity from nuclear. And you can imagine the amount of electricity we use was much smaller, but it was a 420. With 20 being oil. We're now getting less than 2% from oil. We're getting about 20% from nuclear. So nuclear has actually become a major part of our electricity system. The other thing that this doesn't depict all as well, as Jim mentioned, we have over 800,000 megawatts. Nuclear is about 12% of the generation and 20%, 12% of the megawatt capacity and 20% of the kilowatt, the energy, because it operates 24/7. So it's a major player. And if you look at what's being planned or talked about, and I think that looking in the U.S., we have 104 plants. They provide about 20% of our electricity. Worldwide, there's 438 plants, including us. It's about 16% of the electricity. We have about 31 units that are being talked about as part of combined construction and operating licenses that have been announced. Worldwide, there's about 320. One of the points I would make for the series as it goes on and talks about non-proliferation and other issues and waste management is the U.S. has to play a leadership role. If we only built one plant, not 30, we ought to be playing a leadership role in what goes on in the world with the use of nuclear energy. From a safety standpoint, I believe we operate the safest plants in the world. From a non-proliferation standpoint, I think we need to be at the table making sure it's a strong infrastructure. These other countries are going to build plants. I don't believe they're going to build all the ones this 320 makes up. The Kazakhs are planning a bunch, and the Russians are planning a bunch, and I don't see them building them on the timeline that they're saying, but they will build plants. And we should not be absent from the arena, either in our country or worldwide, and that would be one of the themes I would hope carries on as this series goes on. If you look at the 10 largest nuclear generating companies, what you always hear is, why don't we do what the French did? The French get close to 80% of their electricity from nuclear, and we only get a minor 20%. Well, our program's bigger than the next two largest programs in the world combined. Our program's bigger than the French and Japanese programs combined. When you look at what you do with a power plant, which is produce kilowatt hours, we just use a lot of kilowatt hours, which is maybe an opportunity for some efficiency and conservation that Phil was talking about. So we have the largest program in the world from any aspect that you look at it. And that's something that often gets missed because we talk about percent of electricity that's coming out from nuclear in a particular country. In fact, our 787 billion kilowatt hours is more electricity than is used for all but three other countries in the world, not just nuclear, their total electricity demand. It is a very large program. It's just we're a very large country with a very large appetite for electricity. If you look at our performance, one of the things that we're proud of, and Phil basically referred to it, is the sustained performance that we've had. And this is all looking at output. And you could say, well, what about safety? You can't be operating the plants if they're not safe. You can't be operating the plants if you're not maintaining them well because you trip plants, you shut them down, or the NRC shuts you down. And we do have a history of that if you look at the curve back in the early years. So what you're seeing here is a simple picture of sustained performance and output, but it's also a measure of safety. Phil referred to license renewal. Our plants in this country are licensed for 40 years. You can then go back to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and request another 20 years. There's nothing that stops you from requesting 20 years after that right now. You'd have to demonstrate that you're safe to continue to operate, but there's no cap that says, gee, a plant is 40 years old, it shuts down. Just like your car, but maybe a little bit better, there's no moving parts in a nuclear plant that's not in either a predictive, preventive, or corrective maintenance system. Okay, so the plant is not 40 years old, except for probably the concrete and big steel containment vessels. Just about everything else gets replaced as part of a maintenance program. So when you hear a plant is 40 years old or 50 years old, most of the moving parts, the things that can fail, are not. Okay. The next picture here shows our performance from a capacity factor standpoint. And again, it's an indication. Capacity factor is if I have a 1,000 megawatt plant operating 24/7, it would be 100% operations if it operated 1,000 megawatts for 24/7 for a year. This is on a 3-year rolling average, because we do shut down to refuel. So this picks up our refueling and maintenance shutdowns. And when you see the first quartile up there around 96%, that's almost a theoretical limit, because I do have to shut down to refuel and do maintenance. If you talk to the operators, if you ask Mike later, he'll tell you he's shooting for the first quartile for any of his units that aren't in there. We all realize we can't all be in the first quartile. But what you're going to see is the numbers move over as people get better at what they do and get smarter at how they do it. And this has been a big help. One of the things that this increased performance has done, we refer to the fact we haven't built a lot of new nuclear plants. We actually built about 50 in the 80s. Okay, after TMI, we didn't stop. We canceled a lot of plants, but we finished a lot of plants. So the only thing our country built of any significance in the 80s was large nuclear and large coal. Since 1990, the improved performance by our nuclear plants and uprates have added the equivalent of 27 new 1,000 megawatt plants to the grid. So while we haven't added a lot of concrete and steel, improving the performance of the current fleet and uprates that we've done, and the recent restart of Browns Ferry, has added the equivalent of 27 new plants to the grid. Pretty significant help on the electricity system. This tells you what we did since 1992 to 2005. And one of the things you can't see too good up there is how much gas we built. 92% of everything built during that period was gas-fired capacity in this country. So we put a lot of gas on the grid. We put very little coal. We put very little nuclear. The renewables is mostly wind. And that was good. The threat that we have is we're going to build, Dr. Schlesinger referred to the increased order of compressors for gas plants. The threat we have is we'll just build more gas. The more gas we build, the higher the gas prices go, the higher the electricity prices go, an interesting comment made to me by some utility executives is the prices won't go as high as you think, Marv, because we'll have some gas demand destruction. Basically, we'll drive the rest of the chemical industry overseas. So we need to figure out how to get a better mix. That doesn't mean you don't have gas, but it means you've got to get a better mix or you're going to actually mess up our electricity system. Okay, what's driving the interest in new nuclear? Well, the biggest interest is a business interest. There's a real need for baseload generation. Because of all the baseload we built during the 80s, we were able to sort of get through the 90s without building baseload. And you can see we built mostly combined cycle or peaking gas plants. Well, we're now reaching the point where we actually got to add generation that can operate 24/7. In our country, that's primarily coal and nuclear, historically. And if we don't start to add it, we're going to either have a problem on electricity supply. We will get efficiency and conservation because prices will go up and supply won't be there. So you can get it a few ways. You can build it in and do it smart, or you can force it in through market forces, and that's what we might see. Will we build as much nuclear and coal? I don't think so. Phil referred to what's going on with coal plants, and he's exactly right. For every coal plant you hear announced, you can find on page 2 one that's been canceled. And that's what we're seeing, is these decisions are very hard, they're very expensive, and they take a long time. From a country standpoint, from a nation standpoint, we need baseload capacity. So we're going to have to do something smart, or we're going to hurt ourselves from an economic standpoint. If you look at the other reason people are looking at it at nuclear, it's the environmental reasons. We don't emit any greenhouse gases or other air pollutants. Correctly said by both Dr. Schlesinger and Phil Sharp, we're not going to solve the global climate change problem by just building nuclear, okay? But we're part of the solution. And if you don't build nuclear, you're going to build fossil fuels or renewables, and renewables will help, but they don't operate 24/7. Until we learn how to store the energy, we're not going to have them operating 24/7. So we've got to go about this in a smart way and try and get the right mix of what we can put in and deploy it, and it's going to be a challenge. Volatility in gas prices, we saw that. The last cycle from 1992 on, gas started at $2 per million BTUs, and it went up to over 12. We're going to start this cycle at 7 or 8, and we'll see where it goes. And it will be expensive, and it won't be good for our country. It won't be good for other countries, probably. And we are seeing, as Phil referred to, really increasing support from both public and policymakers. I think the hardest challenge is what was referred to by both the previous speakers, is CEO decision making. And Mike will do a good job in talking about in his company. But in general, if you're a CEO looking to deploy a large nuclear or coal plant today, it's a 10-year project. Will you still be there? For most of them, the answer is no. And if it's a success, your successor is going to get the credit. If it's a problem, you're going to get the blame. So it's kind of a tough decision from a CEO standpoint, but we're hoping we get down the road. Oops. It was mentioned about public support, and I think this is a good indication of the support around our plants. This is a survey done in August. It's pretty typical of what you find, with the exception of maybe one facility, of tremendous support around a nuclear plant. There's some good reasons. The reasons you often hear is, gee, they're paying like $20 or $30 million a year in taxes to the local community. The school systems are great. They employ a lot of people. That's all important. There's no question in my mind. I think the most important thing is they live there. They know their neighbors. They talk to them. And the people have confidence in them. As long as the plant is thought of as concrete and steel or a company, you're at a deficit. You're at a disadvantage. When it's people, you actually have an advantage, because people can deal with people real well. That's very strong support. Most of the new plants, not all, are going to be built at existing sites. And that's where our greatest support is. That's where our current infrastructure is best built up for handling it, whether it's transmission lines, water sources, or administration buildings. All helps us on the economics and the deployment. Oops. Okay. New plant, the current situation. Phil referred to the new regulatory process. The new regulatory process deals with some issues we in the industry had. We used to get a construction permit, and then some period later, which could have been anywhere from 5 years to 7 years, we went in for an operating license. I had about 30% of the engineering done when I got my construction permit, and for a lot of these plants, the regulations were still being written. So when I got to my operating license stage, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or the predecessor, the Atomic Energy Commission, had to really review what I built, because a lot of things had changed from the day I started. If I were an intervener, conscientious, I had a lot of questions, because I didn't know what was built, so I'd ask a lot of questions, even if I wasn't maliciously trying to stop the plant. And it took a long time. Seabrook is a poster child for a plant that had a lot of problems up in New Hampshire, and for the cost of the plant. The plant doubled in cost during the operating license stage due to interest on construction. The capital that I had invested was during the time we had high inflation, and we saw 17% interest rates. Okay? So in about 5 years, you doubled the cost of that plant on your carrying charges. Okay? So the fear that investors and CEOs have today is, I get my plant finished and I don't get to operate. It's the construction risk that Phil talked about. The new process is much better. I have to have the engineering done up front. The NRC will issue me the license only with the engineering done under the new process. They can certify a design separate from that, and they can even bank a site separate from that. when I get to the end, they got to make sure, as I build it, that I built what I said I was going to build. And they have a process for doing that, which we can talk about. We have acronyms for everything, and it's called ITAC, Inspections, Test, Analysis, and Acceptance Criteria. Much better process for everybody. I think it's much better for the interveners, too. They get to challenge the engineering when it's known what it is, as opposed to when they're trying to guess what it'll be. So I think it actually helps everybody, and it should help if it works once we demonstrate it. We currently have 4 certified designs, which means the NRC has done rulemakings and said that those designs are safe. We have 1 design being reviewed, and we have 2 that are coming in. We have 3 early site permits that have been issued, which means I banked a site, and we have 1 more that's being reviewed right now for a site that plans on putting a plant on it. Today, the 3rd combined construction and operating license application is being filed by Dominion for the North Anna unit. So we have 3 filed. Mike has a partial application in for Calvert Cliffs, which is the environmental review, and he's going to file the safety review soon. And then there's 18 additional ones. This adds up to about 31 plants. There's about 17 companies involved. These plants are all in the 2015 to probably post-2020 timeframe. I think Phil and Jim said it right. From a very personal, this is not an NEI position, I'd like to go forward with 2 plants and do them right now, and then we build a lot. If we go forward with 10 and we screw up any of them, we're probably going to have a problem getting decisions on others. So doing whatever we do right now is more important than doing a lot. And that's what we're going to try and do as an industry, to make sure whatever we do it right. Okay, just to wrap up a bit, what are the key factors? Well, the first key factor is I got to have competitive electricity costs. It's a business decision from the companies. It's not a government decision. It was actually easy for France when they decided to do what they did. France decided after the oil embargoes that they were going to go nuclear to reduce their dependence on foreign oil. And when they made that decision, it was pretty easy. They had one electric company, EDF. They had 1 reactor supplier, Framatome, and they had 1 fuel supplier, Kojima. They were all owned by the government. So when the government decided to do it, they could do it, and they could do it in families of plants. We basically have a free market. So one of the challenges Mike has and his colleagues in our industry have is negotiating arrangements with their suppliers and coming up with competitive prices. We think we're very competitive in the time frame we're looking at with clean coal and with where we think gas prices will be. The problem is these expensive plants. In the 2015 to 2020 time frame, it's probably $10 to $12 billion for 2 units. Okay, once you look at what the plant costs today, escalate it out to what it could be, that's not a lot different than clean coal. In fact, clean coal, if you go to sequestration, could be a lot more for all I know, but we don't know what that'll be. Gas plants, if these plants are operated the right way, if loan guarantees work the way we think, and you can actually leverage a plant correctly, these plants are competitive with $6 or $7 gas. And gas will be at $6 or $7 because we're going to make it that way, the way we are going to burn gas. But that's a major thing. EPAC was referred to. There's 3 incentives in EPAC. One is a production tax credit at $18 per megawatt hour once the plants are operating. That was to try and get first movers. That's a good thing, but it's not a definitive thing. Second thing is loan guarantees. The bill allows loan guarantees to any non- or low-emitting sources. Loan guarantees are important to our companies because they want to leverage it. They want to leverage wherever they can, particularly if you're in a competitive market. You've got to leverage 80-20 or 70-30 debt to equity. If I can leverage 80-20 versus 50-50, I save about $30 a megawatt hour. Okay, it's a significant impact. Now, am I going to build a plant because they gave me a loan guarantee and not care what happens? Of course not. I'm building the plant because I want to sell the electricity. My reputation's on stake, and I'm still investing over $1 billion in equity in it. So the loan guarantee doesn't cause me to want to go build a plant, but it does allow me to build plants in the market that we have right now, where these are very expensive, and getting the financing, particularly for highly leveraged plants, will be very difficult, if not impossible. So it's important. We need an effective and predictable regulatory process, and Chairman Klein's going to talk about it. We're very complementary of the NRC for putting together a very good, high-quality new reactor organization. They're working very hard to put in place the processes that they need to use to be able to license these plants. It's new for all of us, but it's not totally new. It's just going about it differently. So we think that's going really well. Standardization is critical. Families of plants. Only in America could we be saying that and have five standardized plants going forward at the same time. The French had one. Then they went to the next one. We have five. Okay? It's a competitive market. We're going to see things like that. So we'll potentially have down the road five families. Jim referred to the infrastructure. It's a challenge, but also what it is in reality, it's a planning input. If I can't get my reactor vessel to build a plant by 2015, but I can by 2018, I'll plan my plant that way. So it is a challenge. It's very important. If we start to build here, the suppliers tell us they will begin to deploy here. They will begin to bring back manufacturing and forging capabilities. But it's a chicken and an egg. They want to see people go build before they're going to make investments. And we think we'll see that. Confidence in waste management, Phil referred to Yucca. We need two types of confidence. We need confidence that we have some plausible scheme for ultimately disposing of used nuclear fuel, whether we close the fuel cycle or we still have an open fuel cycle. And we need waste confidence from the standpoint of NEPA reviews for the licensing process. So it's sort of, one is the long-term thing, one is in regulatory space. Maybe the most important thing, at least from my perspective, that we need to get new plants online is to continue safe, reliable performance of the current plants. Nothing is more important, in my perspective, than that. Because we can get all the other things, and if we're not operating safely and reliably, we lose all that good political support that Phil just referred to. NRC loses confidence in our ability to operate, and they're not going to rush to license anything. So to me, that's probably the most important thing. If we get these other things right and don't have that, we probably still don't go forward. I'll stop there, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marv. Our third speaker is Mike Wallace, who is now the Chief Executive Officer of Constellation Energy Nuclear Group. He came here from Commonwealth Edison, in which has 12 nuclear plants and is the largest nuclear operator in the United States. So he has considerable experience. We have been talking in our think tank kind of way of speculating about the future. Here is somebody who is actually going to do something, and he is planning to build a nuclear plant. Mike Wallace.
The applause is supposed to come at the end, not the beginning. Thanks very much, Jim. Appreciate it. Appreciate the context that my fellow panelists here have set to things. I'm going to try and talk very fast and hit only a few high points. A little bit of my own background that's relevant to some of what I'm going to say. I was at ComEd, operated the 12 nuclear units, but prior to that, I was actually the executive responsible for building Byron and Braidwood in the last 6 years, from 82 to 88, four nuclear units. One of my industry colleagues observed some time ago, I'm the only executive left in the industry who actually built one as an executive last time around. And that experience is really coming to be quite relevant. A bit about Constellation Energy, for those of you who may not be so familiar. We're headquartered in Baltimore. We have as our one of our subsidiaries, Baltimore Gas and Electric, local distribution. We're the largest wholesale provider of electricity in the country, not well known, in which case our customers are the distribution companies, ComEd, ConEd, Boston Ed, Pepco, and so forth. We're also the largest retail distributor in the country to commercial industrial customers, General Motors, Ford, Kmart, Walmart, in competitive markets. So we look at the broad landscape of North America, actually including Canada, not just the central territory within which our headquarters is located. We have power plants that generate electricity by coal, oil, gas, solar, five nuclear units, two in Maryland, three in upstate New York. We do not have wind, but literally every other way you can generate electricity, we do it somewhere or else, somewhere or other. Constellation Energy, just 3 years ago, I was thinking as Marv was talking, started considering new nuclear. What should we do, if anything? Literally 3 years and 2 months ago. And then, as you all know, in the fall of 2005, the Energy Policy Act passed, an absolute watershed event. It caused us and others to accelerate forward. So as we sit here today, what I can tell you is we've come a long way. We've formed a joint venture with Areva and picked a technology. We subsequently expanded a joint venture with EDF, who's also deploying the same technology that we're picking. We have over 500 engineers in our team, Areva, Bechtel, EDF, and Constellation, working on the project. We're spending tens of millions of dollars a month. We're seeking to deploy a fleet of standardized units, and I'll get to that some more, and yet we have not taken the decision to build a plant because of some of the factors I'm going to get into. Literally, we're working the critical path to build several plants. The question we face just about 12 months from now is, do we keep that pace up? Are there all the green lights coming on? Or are we going to have to stand down because some of the preconditions are not coming together adequately? And I'll try to show you just what those are. Others have addressed the energy demand situation. As a utility executive and our board looks at it, this is what we see. The colors indicate pricing levels, red, high prices, blue, green, not quite so high yet. And the boxes show you when we hit what's considered to be reserve margin minimums. In particular, if you look at PJM, we hit it this year. We can't get a new nuclear plant online, nobody can, any sooner than 2015. And so what do we do when we hit the reserve minimums and we can't get plants online to 2015? It's a real conundrum that we're struggling with, and I'll give you some of the calculus to that in just a minute. We look at production costs, combination of the operating costs and the fuel costs, and where they have been for coal and gas in particular, and then nuclear. You can see the green nuclear line, a steady trend down. At the far right, you can see a small divergence of nuclear and coal, but that's actually a 30%. You got to look at the scale. Coal is 30% greater than nuclear on a production cost basis. And, of course, you can see where gas is, literally four, five, or six times the production cost for nuclear plants. We look at the environmental issues, CO2. 2 years ago, it was hardly in our lexicon inside Constellation. Now, frankly, it dominates. We absolutely recognize that our customers, our citizens, our shareholders expect us to pay attention to CO2 and pursue non-greenhouse gas emitting technologies. And when we look even at the total life cycle, as you can see, nuclear falls in with geothermal, wind, and hydro in terms of CO2 emissions. Total life cycle, meaning we take account of the CO2 produced just to produce some of the equipment for a nuclear plant, even though the plant itself puts out zero CO2 emissions. We then, in a very simple, obviously actual decision-making, much more complicated, but lay out this table to show the four alternative technologies, coal, gas, oil, and nuclear, production costs, CO2 emissions, and capital costs. And when we've gone through our calculus, we come up with a couple of very succinct conclusions. We will not build a coal plant. We are a merchant or a competitive company. We have no rate base. We take on all the risk of whatever we do going forward forever. We see too much uncertainty and risk in coal plants going forward. Even if we were locked in on the economics you see on this table, we're not very confident about what 3, 5, 10, 15 years out may mean, where carbon sequestration requirements may go, where taxes may go that are put on emissions and so forth. So we're not going to build a coal plant, period. We don't want to build a gas plant, but we may be forced to in order to make sure the lights don't go out. But it is not the right place for us to be because the volatility of the gas supply and, quite frankly, less and less energy independence as we see longer term in the future. Nuclear is absolutely the right answer. And our board has taken the decision that we will, in time, be building nuclear plants in this country. The question is when and how bumpy will the road be before we get there? So our whole approach is what we refer to as a risk-managed approach to get down this path. We're not nuclear zealots. We're not optimists. I don't think we're pessimists. We're really trying to be realists and go at this in a very risk-managed approach in the decision-making that we take. So as we look back, what are all these risks about, and what are the risks we face now? Marv made some mention 25 years ago. What is it that really happened? I have the scars on my back to tell some stories, but, you know, in simple terms, Three Mile Island occurred, and that created a lot of changes. There were literally months at Byron and Braidwood where we took more equipment out of the plant than we put into the plant because it had to be modified, appropriately so, I might add, post Three Mile Island. That created huge inefficiencies and delays. Add to that the double-digit interest rates that we were seeing at the time, and literally cost of our mortgage at Braidwood was $30 million a month as we were finishing the project, $360 million a year just in interest costs. Large overruns, plants were abandoned. Marble Hill in Indiana is a good example. It was sister plant, actually, to Byron and Braidwood. Should have been units 5 and 6 in a replicate series. Zimmer and Shoreham were fully completed. Zimmer in Ohio, Shoreham in Long Island, and effectively never operated, were shut down. Prudency reviews, financial distress, all the bad stuff went on for a decade after we got plants either canceled or online. And then we ran into challenging operations for existing plants in the 80s and 90s. Extended plant shutdowns, early shutdowns in the case of Zion, Connecticut Yankee, and some others. So nuclear was not a very reliable, was very costly, and had all sorts of risks associated with it back in that time frame. That's why we needed changes to the licensing process, which I assume Chairman Klein's going to talk about and Marv referred to a little bit. It's also why we need federal assistance to kickstart this industry moving forward again. What are the challenges in addition that we face today? Well, the nuclear infrastructure is all but gone. When I built Byron and Braidwood, almost all the equipment and materials that we need came from inside the U.S. someplace. I honestly can't think of anything that we actually bought outside the continental United States, although I suppose there were some components. That's not going to happen. Almost everything we will put in the first series of plants is going to come from offshore. There is almost nothing that actually comes from a point of view of equipment materials from within our borders right now. The services organizations, consultants and specialty services are gone. They need to be put back together again. Craft labor. I've been telling my son, who's a chemical engineer, that he probably ought to get his welding certificate because he'll make more money as a nuclear welder than he will as a chemical engineer when we get these plants going. So we've got a whole new workforce that's got to come together. The licensing process I mentioned. The experience from last time around is gone. Building a nuclear plant is just not like building anything else. It's not like a dam or a big fossil plant or a big commercial facility. It has a whole series of complexities that go with how we project manage that kind of an effort. And I think Dr. Schlesinger referred to that risk that we run as well. And then competition for resources. We're not the only ones looking at a nuclear renaissance. The whole world is moving. China recent announcements, actually building the same kind of units that we're going to be building, the EPR. And others are going to be doing the same. So the global supply chain, which is already pretty thin, is going to be really, really stressed. This is a bit metaphorically how, within Constellation, we think of where we were 3 years ago. We talked about all the risks. Again, this is a simplified view of it. But I like to consider that red stack about 5 feet high of risk. And there's 1,000 things that go into that risk stack. 5 feet is too much risk for any corporation to take on. We need to get it down to where it's about 1 foot high. And then that's our job, is to manage risk. But some of the risks in that high stack are not manageable by us alone. Well, from where we were 3 years ago to where we are today, a number of things have happened that have helped to take that risk stack down, going from the left to the right. And the Energy Policy Act is a very big piece of that. In addition, we form partnerships. I mentioned Areva and EDF, and Bechtel is our constructor, and we brought in other companies that will be partnered with us in new plants. The announced ones are PP&L in Pennsylvania, Ameren in Missouri, which will be sites for units 3 and 4 of what we see as the first 6 units that we would seek to deploy. We're looking, Constellation Energy, to make a go for the project decision by the end of next year. And I'll let you know exactly what it is has to fall the right way for the light to turn green. The light's not red anymore. It's definitely yellow, and we're moving very fast. But there's some pretty important preconditions need to be met at that point. This shows actually what the whole sequence looks like. I'm not going to go into all the detail, but you'll have it available on the website to look at more carefully later. The red shows the point at which the first wave of COLAs are being filed, and the conditional agreements on standby support and loan guarantees are being negotiated. And then in the blue comes the construction, the financing, early site prep, and then construction we show 2011 to 2015. Our plan is to put Calvert Cliffs, unit number 3, the first EPR that we will build, maybe the first new nuclear plant in the U.S., online in 2015, to have the COL to pour safety-related concrete in 2011 and to break ground at the end of 2008. Now, the challenge here is between 2008 and 2011, the time at which we get the official license, if we are to stay on the critical path, we have to spend $1.5 billion on a $6 billion project. Or we don't. And we wait 3 years until we get the license, and then we start, in which case 2015 becomes 2018. But if you go to the earlier chart, the need for power, we're struggling with how can we get this done as quickly as we can, risk managed along the way, so we don't expose our shareholders or the company to undue financial risk. The regulatory challenges, Marv mentioned these three in the Energy Policy Act, they are the sine qua non. If we didn't have these, I wouldn't be standing here today telling you we're about to deploy a fleet. It's just that simple, because we are a 17, stock price keeps going up, $18 billion market cap company, $18 billion. I just said a new nuclear plant, $6 billion. Two plants is $12 billion. We can't bet our balance sheet in a competitive market on anything like that. The biggest nuclear operator in the country today is Exelon, the successor to ComEd. Exelon's $53 billion market cap. They can't put plants like this on their balance sheet either. Now, to put those numbers in perspective, ExxonMobil is a $400 billion market cap company. So they can think about things like this, but in our industry, there is no company that can go forward with the kind of financial risk that we're talking about here without getting assistance on the front end. And yet I'm also quick to say, after the first wave, whatever that's determined to be or done, the nuclear industry needs zero assistance of any sort. We don't need financial assistance, we don't need subsidies, we don't need standby support, we don't need production tax credits. All of this is to get over the risk hurdle of these first plants where there is no comfort factor that the financial community can get that these plants can actually be financed. But in the end, they stand on their own merits. I won't go into this table. It lays out the particulars of the three different incentives. Federal loan guarantees, as I said, are the imperative without which we can't move forward on new nuclear. DOE recently issued final rulemaking for how federal loan guarantees would work. We, with NEI and others in the industry, are in heavy dialogue, even today, actually, with DOE on how to move this forward. And we're in dialogue with Congress and the administration as well about supporting DOE's efforts so that we get this done quickly. We can break ground at the end of 08 if the federal loan guarantee program comes together next year in a way that's workable. If it does not, we won't. That is the simple final decision point of a risk we cannot manage. But if that comes together, we'll take all the rest of the risks and be comfortable that we can manage them. And then last, just there'll be slides on the website, a passing comment that I won't take the time to go into. The whole workforce and the infrastructure issues are phenomenal. As we look with NEI at the demographics of the nuclear industry, we estimate that in 5 years, 40% of the people in the industry will be gone. We are an aged group, Phil, and it's just simply going to happen. So we lose 40%. We actually are estimating we'll lose 55% of the engineers that are in the industry today. So where are we bringing in to that labor force, and how are we going to help them understand what it takes, project management, construction management, to be able to do very large, complex projects like this? And then there is the whole critical infrastructure, steel, equipment, and so forth. So the challenges are many, but the path is manageable. Last point I guess I'd make is when our board started looking at this in 2004, the charge that they gave me was build the option and help us understand how to do this. And that's what we did. And as I said, the Energy Policy Act really put us over the top. Today, and I don't want to sound soapy about this at all or patriotic in an inappropriate way, but quite frankly, our board and leadership and Constellation are taking on that there really is a responsibility here to the country to get this done right. Even if it is 2015 and we're all outside of positions of responsibility for what might happen, that's the only way it's going to happen if some people take decisions today, and we're willing to do it, and Constellation's not the only company in the industry that is similarly positioned. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. We have 1 minute left, I believe, for questions.
The way we like it.
Young woman over here.
Hello, my name's Dee. I'm actually a lawyer here in Washington, D.C. Thank you for sharing this information. But for the benefit of the people in the room and also myself, can you each tell us a little bit about your organization, when it was created, what do you do, how many employees you have, where you're headquartered? I guess we started with Mr. Sharp from the Resources for the Future, and then to Mr. Fertile from the Nuclear Energy Institute. And then Mr. Wallace from Constellation Energy. Just a little bit about who you are.
You know, my suggestion is, given the short time we have, all of us have websites, and you can get all of that information, and I would kind of urge you to do that, because I think people have different levels of knowledge about the various organizations here.
I'm not going to sue you. It's really for the benefit of just who you are.
We're a research organization for 50 years here in town.
I'm not going
to
sue you.
No. I'm not worried about being sued. I'm worried about how to best use the time we have available.
Next, sir.
Tom Cochran. I have a question for Phil and Mike. And it goes to the issue of subsidies, and I already know what Marv believes. But Phil, do you believe that would you support additional federal subsidies? When we were on the MIT panel, there was some support for subsidies for first movers, but now the industry's gone well beyond that. And Mike, I understood you to say you didn't need more subsidies, you just needed the government to get their act together on the 2005 Energy Act subsidies. So can we hear it from you that you don't need additional federal subsidies to build your plant?
Tom, mark it down. You're hearing it here. We don't need additional subsidies to build our plant. We do need the 2005 Energy Policy Act provisions to come into a practical, implementable program, and that's really all we're working on.
The funds for the loan guarantee program, I believe, are limited at the moment to $2 billion. There is a measure to increase it to $50 billion, but I assume that going from $2 billion to $50 billion is a substantial increase in subsidy.
That's not what he said.
I said. To be clear, I need the Energy Policy Act to be implemented the way that it was set up. And the loan guarantee program, we get in a long debate on this, obviously, as you know. is not really a subsidy anyhow, because all the costs associated with it are going to be borne by us. It's true, federal government takes the risk that the plant doesn't get built, but that's why we need it, because there's nobody who will take that risk given the history we've had for the past 25 years. But in fact, the cost of the program is all borne by us.
He's the economist.
Indeed, it is a subsidy. It's a non-cash subsidy, but it is a subsidy. Sir.
Mike Lawrence with Battelle Pacific Northwest National Lab. All of you put the waste management issue as a lower tier risk. And more of a political risk than a technical risk, and I don't disagree with that. But it was 25 years ago next month that Congress and the politicians felt they solved that with the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. And yet we don't have that solution yet, and just several weeks ago many of the candidates indicated they would go away from Yucca Mountain and start over again. At what point in time does waste management become an impediment, a serious impediment to the growth and reuse of nuclear energy? And what needs to be done to deal with that?
It's an issue, Mike, that I know you've worked on for years. I think the way you need to look at waste management is in two different perspectives. One is waste confidence, that we can handle the waste safely for some period of time. And clearly, NRC licenses, whether it's in reactor fuel pool storage or dry cast storage, and dry cast storage, they feel comfortable with 100 years. Now, I don't advocate we keep it on site for 100 years, but the first thing you need to do is make sure you can safely manage it, and we can safely manage waste at commercial facilities. The second thing you'd like to do is make sure we got a plausible and implementable and progress on actually ultimate disposal. Well, this administration came out with the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, which is looking at closing the fuel cycle. If you begin to deploy lots of plants, not only in our country but other places, and you go for fuel assurance, closing the fuel cycle may become the right thing to do in our country. And if you're going to close the fuel cycle and close it in a proliferation-resistant way and maybe completely with some sort of fast reactors, you're going to have a very different waste form. And if you have a different waste form, it may or may not be appropriate to go to Yucca Mountain very quickly, or it may go somewhere else. I mean, the reason Yucca Mountain is a good repository is you want a retrievable repository. So the answer, in short, is we got to manage it safely now and have confidence, and I think that's very important, or you can't build new plants. I think we advocate across the industry that the government ought to meet its obligation by setting up some form of regional interim storage facilities. And then as a nation, if we're going to go to close the fuel cycle, we ought to implement a program with decision points along the way that allow us to know where, what we're doing, and when we've got to go to a final disposal site. No matter what we do, we'll have some residual waste we need to dispose of.
Mike Wallace, as you look at the finished plant, which is being built by a company that you are tied into, do the cost overruns and the scheduling delays fill you with trepidation? And I'd like a comment from you as well, Mark.
Just a little later getting it out of your system.
So the simple answer to the question is no, but it's only because we put a lot of time and effort into understanding exactly what the situation is and what it's all about. What Jim's referring to is Finland is building the first EPR at a site called Olkiluoto. And just a couple of things. One, it's being done under the old two-step licensing process, so perhaps 10% of the design was done when they started. Two, this is almost above the Arctic Circle. Those are tough conditions. Workforce coming from 28 countries in different languages. And a whole number of other issues that I put in the category of project management, construction management. More importantly for us, the second EPR today is under construction in Flamanville, France. They're pouring safety-related concrete next week, actually, first safety-related concrete. That plant is about 4 years ahead of what would be the Calvert Cliff schedule. And in typical French fashion, they're building their 59th nuclear unit with the same sort of precision that they built the first 58, maybe most importantly, the last eight, with the last one coming online in 2002. So we're learning off of that experience as being directly relevant for the U.S., and we look at Olkiluoto as being a first-of-a-kind where we'll all get a lot of learning experiences, but it is not a bellwether indicator of what we would expect to see here.
Never forget that France does not have the benefit of Anglo-Saxon law. France operates under the Code Napoleon, which means when the government says something, it happens. We have the benefits of Anglo-Saxon law, so watch out. The interveners are coming. I cannot see John Hamry in the room. Is he back here? Ah. We have John.
Christopher Payne with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Marvin, you observed that perhaps that you were a little disturbed by the prospect of five standardized designs entering the market more or less simultaneously, and so am I. And it seems to defeat one of the key ideas of the original concept behind the nuclear renaissance, that we would standardize on perhaps one or two designs like the French, and really get the costs down and really get the regulatory risks down. And it seems like it's asking the NRC an awful lot to take on, and will actually slow the process by having five new designs more or less entering the market in the same 5 to 10 year period. And I wondered if there's anything that NEI or the industry would do to get together and try to narrow the range of designs. And this also relates to the question of the magnitude of the loan guarantee program. If you didn't have those five designs, you could have two or most three guaranteed units, and everything else would be a follow-on unit and would follow Mike's prescription that they would not need loan guarantees.
Chris, actually what I said was only in America could we have standardized designs going forward and have five of them, and that's because we have a competitive marketplace as opposed to France, where the government does control things. So my feeling is the marketplace will actually work in this case. If the five designs are commercially competitive, what you'll have is you'll have companies willing to go forward with five designs that they believe are commercially competitive. From an NRC standpoint, there is some burden, obviously, the more they have, but they're staffing up for the burden. Licensees pay for all the NRC costs. There's no taxpayer dollars involved there. If the burden is such that the NRC cannot act fast enough, that'll factor into the commercial decision making because you won't be able to get your plant online fast enough. So in my world, ideally, because I sort of agree with Phil, I'd rather have fewer and make sure you don't mess anything up. But I accept our country for what it is. And commercially, people are going to do what makes sense in a competitive marketplace. We may end up better for it because we'll have five potentially good designs which people can then market elsewhere. There'll still be families of plants once the first ones are built. What the industry has done, Chris, is set up design-centered working groups for all five designs so that any of the companies that are interested in Mike's design work together with Mike. If they're interested in the Westinghouse design, they're set up that way.
And recall how vast an improvement we have had over the past, in which each and every nuclear plant was one of a kind with a separate design. The movement towards standardization, while not complete, has been astonishing. Did you want to add?
There's only 50-50 cost-sharing arrangement for one particular, the AP1000 design through NP2010 and the ESBWR through the Dominion arrangement. All the rest are not. Mike's not cost-sharing a thing. Neither are anybody else, and nobody is after the first one. We would hope so.
Back to this is a reflection of the competitive market. Is that a reflection of the competitive market? Is that a reflection of the fact
Chris, we spent an hour discussing this at lunch and couldn't agree, so we won't hear.
Well, thank you very much for the questions. We now turn to the pièce de résistance, the keynote address, and to introduce our speaker, Dr. John Hamry, president of CSIS.